Welcome to a special broadcast from KALW. I'm Hannah Baba. Earlier this month, the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights celebrated its 20th anniversary with a special event at the Oakland Rotunda. The centerpiece of the evening was a conversation about truth, reinvestment, and racial justice, moderated by comedian and activist W. Kamau Bell. Joining Kamau were Eva Patterson, founder and president of the Equal Justice Society, Brian Stevenson, executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative, and Patrice Cullors, co-founder of Black Lives Matter. They talked about subjects ranging from Colin Kaepernick to the presidential election to what reparations can mean today. Here's the evening's host, W. Kamau Bell.
Hey! Give it up for yourselves for being here in this room right now. Give it up for the Ella Baker Center. And in honor of Colin Kaepernick, stay seated. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. My wife says, take out the trash. I'm like, no, I'm seated in honor of Colin Kaepernick. That doesn't work for her. Let's get this panel started. Brian Stevens, everybody. Patrice Cullors. Eva Patterson. Well, thank you for coming. How you folks doing?
Good. Great.
Good.
Good to be in the house. It's a fancy place.
It is a fancy place. Look at this. Is this what the Ella Baker Center looked like 20 years ago? Is this a... when they invited me by the office, it wasn't here. Did I get led to the fake office? Is that what happened, Van? Did I get sent to the fake office? Well, first of all, let's just be clear. This is a panel, and we're in front of these people, but we're here to have a conversation. We're here to, let's let these people eavesdrop in on the conversation if we were in the back of the club or the bar talking about the revolution. Yep. All right, are you guys ready for that? Are you prepared for that? If you like what you hear, shout out, gospel, whatever, do one of these, whatever you do, let us know, all right? There we go, one of those, I can't even do that, thank you. So first of all, I made a little mention of this, and we talked about this a little bit, but I just want to start on something a little bit topical. What are your thoughts on Colin Kaepernick? Because there's a lot of thoughts out there about that, and then we can connect that to what we're here to talk about, truth and reinvestment, but I'm just curious what your thoughts are on Colin Kaepernick.
The brother's fro is real.
I know.
Anybody with a fro like that could kick it with me. no, but in real talk, I think he's... really moved by this moment. And, you know, many of the celebrities, many of athletes, many of these folks are political in their own personal lives. And this moment has allowed them to be more public with their politics. And I think it's amazing. I think it's brilliant. I think it's also, it must be so challenging. Right? To have to stand and believe in what you believe in and have the white racist trolls come after you, law enforcement deciding to, you know, boycott you. And so I'm grateful for the action, and I think what it shows other athletes is, black athletes in particular, that you can stand up, that you, it is in your right to allow folks to see what you believe publicly.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I just want to echo the last thing that Patrice said, because I do think, you know, when I give talks and I talk to young people and I talk to advocates and I talk to people who say they want to make a difference, what I say to them is that you've got to be willing to do uncomfortable things. And he is modeling the doing uncomfortable things. And let's be honest, we have a lot of wealth, we have a lot of influence in the hands of our athletes and our entertainers, and generally speaking, they have not used that wealth and influence to advance the challenges that we are facing in this country. And they've been acculturated into thinking that they're not supposed to do that, and they're not supposed... And I think if we could create a revolution among professional athletes in this country to give voice to the sentiments that the rest of us are giving voice to actually stand with us, to do that hard stuff, think about the impact that will have on this country and this culture. So I'm excited when athletes stand up and do the things that need to be done.
Absolutely.
One of the things that we've been asked to talk with you about is what are things that we can do to make things better in the area, to me, of racial justice. And one of the things that Black Lives Matter has been so brilliant at, and your book has been brilliant at, and your comedy, Emmy Award nominee W. Kamau Bell, yes, is, you know, we've heard about this much vaunted conversation on race. But, and one thing that Van does is he gets people to actually talk about race. I love football, and I watch Inside the NFL with James Brown and that cute little Brandon Marshall and Phil Simms and Boomer Esiason. And 2 days ago, they were talking about this. And James Brown, who went to Harvard, was talking about the fact that Tony Dungy's dad had come back from the war and was treated so horribly. And there you have lots of people who are going to be watching football, having to deal with race and having to deal with the fact that this very rich, successful brother, Colin Kaepernick, feels that racism is alive and well. And then it's brought out the whole thing about the second or third verse of the Star Spangled Banner, which is all about up with racism and up with slavery. So I think it's very important that this conversation is going forward. We got to have the brothers back. I think there's a sister here with this number 7 jersey on. Yeah. So what I would ask all of you to do is have those uncomfortable conversations with people in your lives who think racism's over, because that's what he's forcing us to do. So, and I was going to say, love the brother's fro. Love the fro.
Yes. Yes, I'm experiencing a big case of fro envy right now. But it's for a good cause. So, yeah, so connected to all that, and I'm glad you brought that up, Eva, what does, just sort of get this sort of in an area to talk about, we're talking about truth and reinvestment. What does that mean to you? I have a few questions about this. Is it just a nice way to say reparations? Do we need a nice way to say reparations? Why should we be nice about reparations? What does it mean to you? And everybody can take this. I'll start with Eva. And how do you see that playing out in the world?
This is a very challenging topic for me. And I kept asking them, what does this mean, reinvention, reparations? And here's a couple things I thought. Van and I used to work together back in the day. And we had some clients who had sued in federal court to get reparations. And they lost. And they told us about it, and we represented them. So we took the case up. One of the clients brought up was going to bring a mule across the Bay Bridge to a court. We said, not a good idea. But one of the things we discovered, and I was thinking about this driving here today, for a time, America was the economic behemoth of the world. But think about this. If you had a business, you didn't pay anybody, you'd be really rich. And that's how America got so rich. So we started like figuring out what we're entitled to. And back in the day, it was 40 acres and a mule. This will date me. We decided it would be 40 acres and a Lexus that we would all be given. But I was thinking about the difference between reparations and reinvestment. And this is what I came up with. Let's say you're in Oakland, and you have a beat up car and somebody smashed your car. You were able to get a repair or reparations to put your car in the situation it would have been but for the crash. As lawyers, that's what we do. But let's say that everybody in the community has a beat up car. To me, reinvestment would be buying everybody a new car. Maybe they need 2 cars. Do you need gas subsidies to get to work? So it would be trying to figure out what the needs of the community are that aren't just restorative, but will really move everybody forward. So that's where I came to, that's what I came to in, as the difference between reparations and reinvestment. The other thing I want to say is that Japanese Americans were treated so terribly during World War II. They got some cash money as reparations. So there's precedent for this. So y'all younger folks, get on it so we can get some cash money, all right?
I do think that we shouldn't be afraid to use the word reparations. And I think part of it has to do is that if we hurt somebody, if we actually do something that's wrong, to actually get back to our peace, we want the person to know that we are sorry. We want to do that not just for the person who has been victimized by the wrongdoing. We have to do it for ourselves. And we actually haven't created the kind of conversation in this country where I actually think reparations would be good for all of America. I really do. We have created identities in many parts of this country. I flew in here yesterday, And I got picked up at the airport, and the chatty cab driver, he says, "Where are you from?" I said, "I'm from Montgomery, Alabama." And then there's that long silence where he's trying to figure out, okay, well, what am I going to say now? And I just said, "I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, why are you in Alabama?" And there is an identity that is connected to that state. And the truth of it is, we need to change our identity as a nation. We're a country that does not believe in saying, "I'm sorry." We actually think, "I'm sorry" makes you weak. We know in our relationships that saying, "I'm sorry," actually makes you strong. You can't be in love with somebody 20 years and not learn how to say, "I'm sorry." That's how you build strength in a relationship. And in this country, we haven't done it. We think that we are just beyond that. We do pride great, we do winning great, we do glory great, we do the Olympics great, but we do not owning up to our mistakes well. And so for me, we've got to push this country into that. And I actually think it's critical that we talk about it now. You know, we should have done it at the end of the Civil War. We didn't. We should have done it at the end of the era of terrorism when we were lynching people. We should have done it at the end of segregation. And we didn't. And one of the reasons why I think we're still struggling is that we keep losing the narrative war. We won the Civil War, but we lost the narrative war. We let people in the South actually feel like they had done something wonderful. And the landscape is littered with the iconography of these monuments and memorials to Confederacy. We got them to stop lynching in public with crowds and impunity, but we lost the narrative war. We didn't hold anybody accountable. We won the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, but we lost the narrative war. We didn't hold anybody. So I think that's what we have to do. And for me, what reparations means is that these states that denied people the right to vote, if they were serious about recovering from that, reparations would mean Black people shouldn't have to register to vote in this country. I don't think they should. I think you should be automatically registered if you're Black. And it would say, "We are sorry to Black people in this country for denying you the right to vote." I actually think it would not be irresponsible for states to say, "You know what, on election day, we're going to come to your house and get your vote. You don't have to go to the polls on election day." And since we've lost so much time, if we really want to make up on some of the time we lost, we might want to say, "We're going to register you to vote. We're going to come to your house. And you know what? Because you're Black, you get to vote twice." I do. I know it's not going to happen. It's sort of a joke. But I'm actually serious. Think what that would say to people in this country about a recognition that what we said to Black people, "You can't vote just because you're Black." I think in these schools, these states that didn't allow Black people to go to school, I think we should say, "No, you get to come to our college and university. You don't have to pay what white people pay." And then you begin to shift. That identity shifts. In Germany, they want you to know they are sorry about the Holocaust. You can't go 100 meters in Berlin, Germany, without seeing a marker or stone placed next to the home of a Jewish family. They want you to go to Auschwitz and reflect on that legacy. In this country, we don't talk about slavery. We don't talk about lynching. We don't talk about segregation. And now we are struggling. And so we've got to repair, and I think we can create a movement that gets everybody to see that it's in their interest to support reparations too.
Absolutely, absolutely. Before I go to you, Brian, is there any way to get that 2 Black votes per Black person before Trump? Is there any way to do that before November? Can we get that every Black person gets 2 votes? I know you're a lawyer. You can figure it out, can't you? Or how about just only Black people voting? Can we do that? Is that... Either way. Patrice.
I don't think I have much to say. I mean, the both of you really broke that down. I think when I think about, you know, when we talk about truth reinvestment at the Ella Baker Center, there's a reason why. Hi, Latifah. That's sister in the audience. You got to say hi to family. When we talk about truth reinvestment at the Ella Baker Center, there's a reason why we're saying truth reinvestment and not truth and reconciliation. And I think the reinvestment, well, the truth piece is really about this country reckoning, coming to a reckoning with its destruction that it's caused, not just inside of the U.S., but outside as well. Yes, you can clap for that. I think there's, you know, I come from a family who are a lot of recovering alcoholics. And the first sign of recovery is coming out of denial. This country is in deep, deep denial about the harm it's caused domestically and abroad. And I think that truth is a really, really important marker of being able to move forward. And the reinvestment piece is about saying we are no longer going to invest in destroying communities. We're going to reinvest
and to building up communities. We are going to, and reinvestment also, it also is about divestment. If we're going to reinvest in something, we must divest from something else. And so our call is really divesting from the police state, divesting from the prison state, and reinvesting into poor communities, Black and brown communities in particular. And it's not hard, actually. What we've seen that's been hard is the last 30 years of criminalizing communities. We've seen the utter destruction and decimation of our neighborhoods because of the police and prison state. And so what's not difficult is to make people feel safe. And people don't feel safe when there's a gun and a badge. People feel safe when they can get up and go to work in the morning. People feel safe when they can feed their children at night. And that really is the conversation about reinvestment. And I would say, you know, I was also thinking about what's the difference between reinvestment and reparations. And I think reparations, the way I was taught it and the way I understand it, is it's reparations allows another conversation, which is around self-determination. That article that came out, right, where Black folks, if we were to really close the gap, it would take 228 years. What? I don't even understand that. That means we would, that means the government would actually need to give us reparations, and probably like on a yearly basis. It wouldn't be just like one lump sum. We would have to reconstruct this entire nation into a nation that centers Black people. And I think that is how I think about reparations.
And I think one of the things when we say reparations is there's a sense that to that white people, can I say white people? Is that all right to say white people? Is that all right? Is that good? And even like white people on the right, but even good white people, like the white people here. it's cool, some of my best whites are friends. All right. Even good white people hear the word reparations or if they truth and reinvestment, and there's a fear. And how do we address that fear? And I mean, because I think we have to engage with those people to win them to the side of this argument. But how do you engage with that fear? Because taking it to the car analogy, I'm sure there's some white person going, they're going to come get my car. You're going to take my cars, you can have two cars. You know, that's the reparations or the truth and reinvestment argument that always happens is that somehow it's going to take away from white people. So how do you talk about that? Anybody can step in.
Well, can I just start on that? I mean, I think actually there is fear. But we ought to be more afraid of the fact that we are in the 21st century and we are still not free in this country. We are not. We are living in a country where our history of racial inequality has created a kind of smog, and we're all breathing it in. Black, brown, white, we are all breathing it in. It doesn't take much. And so we actually have so much to gain if we begin to work on this narrative. I really want to be, what I say to people is, look, I'm a criminal defense attorney. I've defended people who've done really terrible things. I'm not really interested in punishing America. I want to liberate America. I want us to get to a place where we feel this stuff. But to do that, we have to talk about things we haven't talked about. I actually think one of the things we have to talk about is that this is a post-genocidal society. Before white settlers came to this continent, millions of native people lived on this continent, and there was a genocide. We slaughtered them by the millions, and we ignored doing the things you're supposed to do as a post-genocidal society by saying, oh, you know, those people are different. And that narrative of racial difference was created, and then we had slavery. And we haven't talked about slavery. I don't think the great evil of American slavery was involuntary servitude and forced labor. I think the great evil of American slavery was the narrative of racial difference, was the ideology of white supremacy that we created to legitimate slavery. And the 13th Amendment doesn't deal with that. And you read that, and that's why I think, you know, slavery didn't end in 1865, it just evolved. And that narrative has continued through the terrorism and the lynching and the segregation. So I actually think if we offer this country true freedom, they can actually get behind the kinds of things that we're talking about. Because ultimately, it's in all of our interest to live in a place where we are truly free, and we are not in that place yet.
What you're asking is extremely profound, because I remember somebody's... You're very welcome. You're very welcome. Someone talked to me about the fact that it's not... that things are not just kind of unequal in America, but they're unequal all around the world. So does that mean that I, to make things fair, have to give up my car, my three-bedroom house, and it's like, oh, no, no, I don't want to do that. So if that's how I'm acting, I can imagine how other people are feeling about things, because people know things are not fairly distributed, and nobody wants to give up stuff. So I don't know how to have that conversation. I don't know if it's, you know, we need to talk about Marxism. Oh, my God, did I say that?
It's cool. We're in Oakland. It's cool. It's cool.
Redistribution of wealth. I mean, it's really pretty deep. I think you all have been so brilliant, and you've been so brilliant about dealing with the criminal justice system. And you think about the fact that there are corporations getting rich off the bodies of black and brown people who are being incarcerated. And that just happens every day as though that's normal. And nobody, Obama challenged it with the feds, which is very good. But it's so deep in our system, the inequities are baked in. I think conversations like this are good. I don't have the answer to this. I just sue people. That's what I do.
To start, that's a good start, yes. Therese, do you have any thoughts about how do we engage with people who have no interest in getting reparations taken out of their paycheck?
No, not that, but the piece around the fear, I have some thoughts around, which, I mean, fear is physiological. It's not something that actually happens in our logical mind, it happens in our body. And that actually is deep to me, because it means that people are trained to fear others. And so I think there's this conversation about retraining our bodies around how we respond. And I remember a lot of these conversations after Trayvon was killed, because the whole conversation about Trayvon was he looked suspicious, which was really the brother just had a hoodie on and he was black, right? That's what that code was. And so a lot of conversations started happening in this country about how white people are actually legitimately afraid of black people. And that those types of conversations about retraining how we see each other is absolutely critical, because you can't, your logical brain can't stop the ways that racism plays out in your physiology. It just can't. But we can retrain ourselves. Conversations aren't good. This panel is not going to do that. It's the everyday conversations. It's how you raise your babies. It's how you look at each other. It's the moment you see a black person and you clutch your purse or you lock your doors. It's noticing that and rewinding and stopping yourself. It's noticing that, telling somebody else, another white person, not a black person. I don't want to hear that. But another white person saying, I just did this really messed up thing and I need deprogramming. And a lot of anti-racist white groups are popping up around the country that's doing some of that deprogramming. And I think it's very, very powerful work. And I actually think it's the evolution of our work, because it's in our bodies that we carry sexism, patriarchy, homophobia, transphobia. It's why we see black trans women being murdered in our communities. And you hear, you know, the murderers say, I couldn't stop myself. There was their bodies physically and physiologically reacted, and we have to do that deprogramming. So that to me is an evolution in our work.
Yes.
Since we're acting like we're in a bar chilling, let me riff off something that you said. One of the things that we have been doing as civil rights lawyers is building on the legacy of the lawyers who knocked out Separate But Equal. They use social science to show how segregating the races has a corrosive impact on everybody. Some of you have heard of the baby doll experiment, yeah, where they gave people a black and white doll, and the black doll was always bad, the white doll was always good. We've been investigating this, and what you're saying is even deeper than you may know. When many people see our faces, they associate us with apes. When they see Latinos, they associate us, subconsciously with insects. African American kids are seen as being older than they really are. If you have a picture of a black kid and a white kid, they assume the black kid's older, Tamir Rice. I just came across the most odious YouTube thing I've ever seen that basically said Michelle Obama is really a man. And I was just like, I couldn't watch it. But what we have learned from social science is that black women are seen as masculine. We're not seen as real people. So in addition to the really deep economic work that needs to be done, there's deep, deep, deep psychological work that needs to be done, not just for white folks, but stuff we've internalized. So this is really deep. I feel like I'm depressing myself up here today.
You stay off YouTube. You can find some really scary things on YouTube. That is a... And also, don't ever look yourself up on YouTube. I found that out. One thing I want to address, I want to riff on your riff since we're in the bar. I found what you said about black people being seen as older than white people. I mean, they were calling a 32-year-old man, Ryan Lochte, a kid.
Thank you.
This 32-year-old man with his friends who went out into Rio and caused some trouble and went home, they're just a bunch of kids. They're just a bunch of kids. What can you expect from a 32-year-old man? Whereas, like, you get to Trayvon Martin, where you get to, like, a Tamir Rice, who's 12, is seen as a man.
But, you know, I think that's at the heart of what we actually have to start calling out. Like, you know, I think the legacy of this narrative of racial difference that we've been dealing with is that today in America, black and brown people, all of us, are burdened with a presumption of dangerousness and guilt. And it does not matter how smart you are, it doesn't matter how many degrees you have, it doesn't matter how much money you have, you will go places in this country and you will be presumed dangerous or guilty. And that presumption of dangerousness and guilt, it weighs on you. And we've got to call it out because we won't actually be free of it until we start talking about it. And I think one of the challenges, and it's in that implicit bias stuff, it's all that stuff, is that, you know, and I want to say this to people of color, because I'm, you know, I'm 56, and I'm going to say to you, it's actually exhausting constantly having the burden of making the people around me be okay with my blackness. It's exhausting. And you can wear yourself out trying to make the world work with it. And what we really need is to step back and say, you know, we got to take on this presumption. We got to start talking about the ways in which our minds have been acculturated to see blackness as dangerous, brownness as a threat. And that's where I think this truth-telling is so important. You know, the powerful thing that Patrice and others have done, in the 1960s, there were three words that radicalized the thinking of a generation of people. When I was a little young kid, the three words that just got everybody thinking differently, those three words were black is beautiful. And a whole generation of people just started thinking, we thought of ourselves, that's when we started growing our afros, that's when we started actually embracing our black, and a cultural revolution began with that. And that's the power of Black Lives Matter. Those three words are actually reacculturating us to see our value and our worth. And we've got to run with that. We've got to stand with that. We've got to go with that.
I want to riff off you because one of the requirements for the Stand Your Ground law is that you feel threatened. Just seeing us makes people feel threatened, so basically that means you can shoot any black or brown person you see. The other thing, you're talking about the exhaustion. Somebody had a great t-shirt that maybe Ella Baker Center should market, and it says, "I'm tired, I've been black all day."
I happen to be married to my partner's wife, and she. So sometimes I come home, she's like, "What's wrong?" "Just racism." "Nothing in particular, just the whole system weighing me down all day." Nothing happened, but I didn't try to go buy coffee, but not other than that, just racism. So this is a big issue, truth and reinvestment. If there's one part of the system you feel like we could focus on, or that you'd like people to focus on to put their change agency into, what would that part of the system be? If you could wave a magic wand over that part of the system.
For me, criminal justice, for sure. And I say that because, one, I grew up in a neighborhood where, by the time I was 12, almost every single young boy had been arrested. I remember, you know, little Matthew got a life sentence, a youth life sentence in our neighborhood, and he just was disappeared one day. I remember the rise of militarization of police, and so helicopters, battery rams, LAPD patrolling, and I remember how much anxiety, rage, and just confusion that brought to our community. I think about it a lot now that I'm older. There was all these young people. What an incredible opportunity to really train them, to bring in resources. But instead, the resource that was brought in was LAPD. And I think from there, really witnessing the revolving door of the jails and prisons and visiting so many prisons in the state of California to visit my father or to visit my brother, and the impact that had on my life, my mother's life, my siblings' life, and then eventually noticing my community and saying, almost everybody has been to prison or jail, has been arrested or has been killed or brutalized by law enforcement. And that to me, if we can crack that, if we can shut that down, if we can build something new, I'm an abolitionist, so if we can abolish that system, and the act of abolishing also means the act of imagining. I say this a lot, but someone imagined a jail cell, someone imagined chains, someone imagined handcuffs. We are obsessed with imagining Black death, but we are not obsessed with imagining Black life. We have to imagine something differently. Yeah. And that's my charge to this the people in the room, to folks that I talk to, is it's up to us to imagine something differently. It's up to us to believe that we can have more than human beings living in cages. We're an imaginative, creative group of human beings. We can deal with harm in our communities, and we have in the past. We have to remember, we've not always had police. Mm-hmm. We've not always had jail cells. Yeah. So then how did we deal with each other? How did we live with one another? And I think for me, challenging the criminal justice system actually allows us to challenge so many other systems in our society.
Brian.
I want to echo that completely. I mean, we should take pause and reflect on the fact that, you know, the prison population in this country has been largely stable through most of our history. Throughout the 20th century, it didn't go up very much. And it really starts in the 1970s when we go from 300,000 people in jails and prisons to 2.3 million people in jails and prisons today, 6 million people on probation and parole. And a statistic that a lot of people don't know, there are 70 million Americans with criminal arrests in this country, 70 million, which means that when they try to get a job or try to get a loan, they're disfavored. So I absolutely believe we have got to work in that space if we really want to see things change. We went from $6 billion in spending on jails and prisons in 1980 to $80 billion last year. If we cut the prison population in half, and Van and Cut 50 and so many people and Ella Baker are pushing for this reduction, think what we could do with $40 billion in reinvestment, how we could change neighborhoods and communities. And like Patrice, it just breaks my heart. Listen, I go into communities and sit down with 12 and 13-year-old boys who, when I have an honest conversation with them, will say to me, Mr. Stevenson, I know I'm going to be in prison by the time I'm 21. And they say that because that's what they're seeing in that in their community. And that wasn't true when I was a little boy. That wasn't true when my father was a little boy. And so we have got to see the threat created by this system of incarceration and excessive punishment. It is literally destroying the spirit of so many parts of our community that we've got to protect our spirit. That means engaging with this. And for me, what that means is actually not just talking about reform, but pushing, insisting on it. One of the things I'm afraid of, doing a lot of work in Washington, but you know, 90% of the people in jails and prisons are not in the federal system, they're in the state system. We gotta do work here in California. We've gotta do work in these state legislatures. You know, California, and while I'm here, I'll just put this plug in if you don't mind. There's a ballot initiative here in California this November to end the death penalty. We need to support it. California spends $200 million a year to keep people on death row. It's the largest death row in this country. Over the next 5 years, we'll spend $1 billion on the death penalty, and nobody will get executed. Let's end the death penalty in November. Let's us make that happen. Take that $1 billion and reinvest in the kinds of communities that we want to see here in California. For me, that's where we can raise that wand.
Say something that's probably going to get me run out of here, and that is that I actually agree with Donald Trump on one thing. One thing.
Settle down, everybody. Settle down. She said one thing. It could have been about water being wet. Let's all settle down.
He says the system is rigged, and he knows because he's rigging it, you know, day and night. But the thing I would change is how elections are financed, because big money drives policy. So I would have full public financing of all elections. One of the reasons we have so many prisons is because the prison industrial complex, they lobby the legislators, and the legislators need the money to run. So it's kind of a nerdy thing, but I think that if we changed how elections are financed, it would make a big difference. And also the redistricting, because you've got a House of Representatives that's just full of knuckleheads, and they keep voting for knuckleheads, and they block everything. They want the Senate, I guess the House put some riders on the Zika funding that would defund Planned Parenthood, huh? You know, we won't get rid of Zika because we want to take away a woman's right to choose, but that's about how redistricting is done. So I'm kind of a nerdy person on this. I completely agree with them, but there's some nerdy fixes that I think could make a difference as well.
So we're sort of leaning into a little bit into the current political system and the election. So first thoughts, I mean, President Obama, I'm going to read this, make sure I get the stats right, has commuted at last count 673 prison sentences, more than the last 10 presidents combined. He plans to do more, and recently the federal government announced that they plan to stop using private prisons. In the last few years, there's been some bipartisan support on prison reform. I think even the Koch brothers have talked with people about it. What are your thoughts on this? What are your thoughts on Obama's last days in office? And then we'll get to the other stuff. As far as it connects to this.
I mean, I think it's really important. I think it was great that the president went to a prison. I think it's important that we elevate this issue. But I think we should not rely on the White House or people in Washington to solve this problem. As I've said, 2.3 million people in jails and prisons, less than 200,000 are in the federal system. And I think we actually have to change what we want people in Washington to do. I support all the sentencing reform bills that are pending before the Congress. But what I really want to do is to go back to the 1990s, actually during the Clinton years, and kind of visit what they did in 1994 was that they actually created a funding system to give to states to eliminate parole, truth in sentencing laws. We actually gave millions of dollars to the states to keep people in prisons for a really long time. If we're serious, what I want the president and the Congress and our political leaders to start talking about is a new truth in justice system, where we're going to give money to states to actually bring down the prison population, to restore the kind of mechanisms that kept people out of jails and prisons. That would actually be the most radical and useful thing Congress could do. And it's not crazy, because we gave the money away to keep people in prison. Let's give the money to the states to incentivize these releases. And I do think the president gets it. I think these pardons are really important. I'd like to see him actually broaden the pardon, so we're not just pardoning people who should have never been in prison in the first place. I think it's actually really a pardon when you actually pardon somebody who was convicted of a crime, but you now realize that they're more than the worst thing that they've done, and you say, you know what, this person should go home. And that's the kind of pardoning that I hope we'll see. But I think it's important that we're talking about criminal justice reform, but I want to just leave with this warning. You know, don't be confused that you've got a presidential candidate talking about I'm the law and order candidate. That narrative of fear and anger, that politics of fear and anger is on the rise. And we will not see the change we hope to see if we don't fight back against that narrative in every way possible.
Absolutely.
I have a couple of thoughts about Obama. It's so complicated, isn't it? Because I remember that A. Philip Randolph went to Franklin Roosevelt, and he wanted to have some changes, and Roosevelt said, make me do it. And we didn't make Obama do a lot of things, because we were, the brother's the president, and he was catching hell from all the other crazy folks, so we gave him a pass on a lot of things. So it's very, very complicated. Love the brother. We'll never see the likes of that family in the White House again. Who's the guy? So John Hope Franklin said, more important than Obama being president was the fact that there was a black family in the White House. And that has made these people out of their minds. Because a kind of narrative, I love your talk using narrative. One of the narratives after the Civil War, when poor white people and freed slaves were getting together, the bad guy said, oh no, we can't have this alliance. And so the myth was out there, well, you may be poor, but you're not black. And that's kind of what has driven a lot of these people, these alt-right, but let's call it what it is, white supremacists, these people crazy because they can't deal with the fact that there's a black person in the White House. So we don't want to make him feel bad because he's being treated so badly, but he could have done more, but we're glad of what he's doing, and we're sure going to miss him. So that would be my take on things.
Absolutely. That's one of my complicated feelings about Hillary, too, is that I don't really feel that great about her, but also I feel like for my kids, both my kids are born during the era of the Obama presidency, and if Hillary becomes president, I can be like, yeah, kids, sometimes the president's a black guy, sometimes it's a lady. That's just how it works in this country. Just goes back and forth like that. That's how we do it, yeah. So looking forward, I can assume your thoughts on Trump. We don't have to spend time that, but what are your thoughts on the next, what substantive changes do you think we could make in the next 4 to 8 years, no matter who's in the White House, as far as this goes?
I think the Republicans have this whole idea that they put out when Obama came in, we're just going to block, 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 block. We're not going to let him do anything at all. And I think they're going to do the same thing with Hillary if she gets in. Because there's deep, deep misogyny in the country. Did you know that? And there still are some people who don't think a woman is qualified to be president. It's like, what? But that's out there. So they hate her. They hate Bill. They hate the Democrats. They hate women. And so I think they're just going to block, block, block. The Democrats may take back the Senate, but what I talked to you about before, the redistricting, I think, leaves the House in the hands of the Republicans, and so they're just going to block everything. So we've got to figure out, and I'm glad the Ella Baker Center is here, because we need to figure out what we do as organizers and pushing, 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 and what we can do on a local and state level. So that's what we have to do, just fight, 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 and then people like us will sue as well. So
sue, 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 sue.
Yeah, I think the local work is key in this moment. I think it's been key in the last 8 years. I think it'll be key until we see exactly what we want in this country. Yeah. It's our local work that makes the national. And I think, you know, no matter who becomes the president, I believe the movement will continue to grow. I think the movement will continue to take a stand. I think, you know, it was really important for us in those first few months when the candidates were presenting themselves that we interrupted the Democratic Party in particular over and over again. And many people were like, well, don't you see Trump is running? And we were like, yes. And everybody knows what his platform is. But what we've seen time and time again is the Democratic Party milk the black vote. And we actually need to stand up and say, we need much more from you. If you're going to be supposedly representing us, we need you to show up for us. And I don't think we've seen that yet. And I think, you know, part of that looks like the building, the being unapologetic about building a black agenda. I said it earlier, which is I think that candidates, and that's at the local level and the national level, 2 minutes for the whole thing or 2 minutes for me? Okay.
Oh, is that where the sign is?
Yeah.
I was looking down here. I'm sorry, yes.
So I think that we need to not be comfortable. I think we got really comfortable with Obama. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know that I was like, finally, we're 8 years of Bush was hell. Yeah. And we had this brother come in and the family, and I think it really swept us up. And we got comfortable. And I think this movement doesn't allow for us to be comfortable. And this push for the Democrats in particular to show up differently is going to be critical.
Before we go in our last 2 minutes, just can you, since I missed the sign, sorry about that. What is one thing you would like everybody here to do to push this idea forward? What can you think of anything that you think people in this room can do as they leave here? I feel like they have these panels, we talk about these things, but what would you recommend people here do?
I'm going to restate one thing, but I'll just say this very quickly. I hope you will think critically about what should happen in the first 100 days of the administration, because that's the time when we actually lost a lot of really incredible opportunities when President Obama was elected in 2008. As a lawyer, I think we have to fight for rights. You know, we're not going to win a lot of things. I'm from Alabama. We're not going to win anything at the polls. We've got to protect the rights of people. Look, we have marriage equality in this country, not because of what happened in the polls, but what happened in the court. And we can push this president to actually make the kinds of appointments that change our ability to fight for the most vulnerable people. Undocumented people need that. People living the margins need that. People in jails and prisons need that. So start thinking about what you're going to insist on that this president do in the first 100 days. And then I'm just going to repeat the thing I said before. Please stand with us. Please fight with us on ending the death penalty in California. Get involved in supporting and being activists in support of this proposition so we can end that punishment.
There's a couple things I would have you do, and the first one's going to be really hokey. But I think, and Van talks about this too, I think we've got to do what we do with love. The only person I can't do that with is Trump. I'm just sorry. I can't. But everybody, we need to do it with love and respect for the other side. For the people of color in the room, I think what you need is to talk with people from another race or ethnicity about your reality so that they understand that. There's something I call black magic where, and my friend Paul Henderson talks about it, where people will not sit by black people on BART or public transportation. And I told that to a Filipina friend of mine. She said, what? And then she started watching and she said, you know, that's true. So we need to tell people what it's like to be black or gay or a woman or older. And then the white people in the room, you all probably have unusual relatives. We all have those unusual relatives who say things at Thanksgiving. And so you can let it slide or you can try to educate them. I think a lot of what we have to do is very personal. I believe in movement, but there's the personal one-on-one engagement. Van turned Newt Gingrich around. Amazing. Newt Gingrich was talking about racism, saying that black people have it worse than white people. I said, Van Jones did that. So we need to do that. Movement's important, but the one-on-one. And then the last thing is take care of yourselves. Life is short. Take vacations. Take care of yourselves. And love the people who love you.
I know that there's gonna be a pitch later, but donate to Ella Baker Center, first and foremost. Donate to your local org. For those of you who know the work of organizing, it's treacherous, and so every dollar counts, so please be generous tonight. To join the Ella Baker Center. Join, become a member. We have monthly meetings, so you can, you know, if staff's in the house, raise your hand high. People can see you, raise your hand. People can see you. Good, they can tell you how to join the Ella Baker Center. And then lastly, join the movement. Four of us did not sit up here to entertain. This was just another part of organizing. If you have not joined, if you came with a friend tonight and they're like, hey, this cool thing's happening, we're hoping that after tonight that you join our movement. And it's messy and powerful and beautiful and amazing, and we would welcome you. So thank you.
And give a round of applause for our panel, everybody. Eva Patterson, Brian Stevenson, Patrice Cullors. Thank you. I'm W. Kamau Bell. Appreciate you. Join the movement.
This has been a special broadcast from KALW, recorded at the 20th anniversary celebration of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. W. Kamau Bell moderated a conversation featuring Equal Justice Initiative founder Brian Stevenson, Eva Patterson, president of the Equal Justice Society, and Black Lives Matter co-founder Patricia Cullors. Thanks to the Ella Baker Center for inviting KALW broadcast this program, and to W. Kamau Bell and Jessica DeJesus for their roles in making it happen. The program was recorded for KALW by Dan Gunning and produced for broadcast by Ted Muldoon, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, and Debbie Kennedy. Hana Baba was the host. Thank you for listening, and if you appreciated this program, please share it.